Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. President Trump announced $12 billion in aid for farmers to help ease the financial strain they're feeling, the strain caused by the Trump administration's trade policies. Some farmers, like those that grow soybean and corn, will get direct payments, while farmers in need might see this as a relief. Legislators criticize the president's policies. Here to discuss these policies and what's to come, it's our Reporters Roundtable. Jeremy Pelzer, political reporter for Cleveland.com. Jeremy, welcome.
Hi.
Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning.
Fresh back from a Hawaiian vacation.
Oh, yeah.
he's glowing.
I can't tell you how happy I am to be back.
I'll bet you are. And Andy Chow, State House reporter for Ohio Public Radio and the State House News Bureau. Andy, welcome.
Good morning.
All right. We got the bros here today, all guys. It's vacation time and Ann's out sick, so it's just us guys here today. We didn't intend it this way, but that's the way it is. Anyway, let's talk about this, the farm aid. This all started when the Trump administration placed tariffs on steel and aluminum primarily. China retaliated by placing tariffs on soybeans. It's a huge industry here in Ohio, obviously. If you drive around central Ohio, you see many a soybean field. Andy, the bailout, the $12 billion in aid. How much will it help Ohio farmers?
Well, it's yet to be seen, because the problem here is that farmers have been complaining for the past couple of months now, ever since the president really started talking seriously about these tariffs, that this is creating a very volatile market where they're not having access to the markets that they usually go to. They're seeing their prices drop. They're just seeing numbers falling here and there and everywhere. And so it's hard to see just how much this aid would actually help. If you ask Governor John Kasich, which we did last week when he was touring the state fair, he said that farmers don't want these bailouts. Farmers don't want subsidies. They want access to the marketplace. This is the thing that farmers rely on. If you think about the agriculture industry in and of itself, it's an industry that calculates, you know, how much crop you're going to put online, how much crop you're going to sell. They plan for this far in advance. And so to sort of cut off that supply, to cut off access to the markets, and then all of a sudden pump in money, it's not quite what farmers are looking for.
An Ohio State University study predicts that Ohio soybean farmers would lose about $250 million in Chinese exports alone. That's half of their income, mm-hmm. Because of the tariffs. Another $12 billion could possibly help. But it just shows you this is the game of Jenga that you play with trade policy. You pull out one block to solve one problem, but then there are other blocks that could fall. You place a tariff on aluminum and steel. China retaliates with soybeans and pork. And what's next? Where's the next $12 billion in aid go to?
Right. And well, this is why trade policy is a very complex and nuanced thing. And it's also why when you start talking about doing things like tariffs, it's experts say it's generally a good idea to first get a coalition of your allies together in order to make it more effective, rather than just shotgunning it out there on your own. Because it, you know, if your goal, and I do believe that Donald Trump has some goals in mind, and I think there are a number of his supporters who agree with him that, you know, we want better trade deals, we want to improve our trade deficit with countries, and China is our biggest one. I think of our entire trade deficit, I think 51% of it is from China alone. There's definitely some disagreement about whether this is the way to go about it. And my thought on this has been, I mean, you just think about, could anyone have imagined, 10 years ago that people would be saying, oh, you know, we're going to have a Republican president who's going to impose tariffs And then propose a $12 billion government bailout because of those tariffs. I mean, that is not something I would expect to come out of a conservative party, because let's face it, that $12 billion, the federal government doesn't have it. They have to borrow that $12 billion. Yeah. And so it's kind of an unusual, this would be more of a thing I might expect to hear from someone like a Sherrod Brown or someone on a more liberal perspective on trade.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Jeremy, Sherrod Brown he won't give Donald Trump the credit in name, but, you know, he generally supports the tariffs on aluminum and steel, saying that these are a step in the right direction to help restore the steel industry in Ohio.
Absolutely. This is, as Jim said, this is something that's kind of bottom more of the Sherrod Brown playbook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're coming up on the midterms now. And with Donald Trump in 2016, a lot of the reason for his victory here was because of the rural vote. He just ran up the score in all these small rural counties. And now it'd be interesting to see how this might affect the midterm elections.
Andy, you're out at the state fair. Granted, it's just a microcosm of the agricultural sector of the state. But what was the – did you get any reaction from folks out there? What were they – what were farmers saying about these policies and how it might affect them?
Like you said, yeah, it's hard to get a good understanding from just a small – well, it's a big group of people there, but, you know, they don't represent everybody. But the sense we're getting is that farmers are unhappy with what they're seeing. I mean, I go back to the whole argument that farmers get used to things and they try to rely on the market. They try to rely on being able to sell to the people they've always sold to and then moving up the ladder. And so disrupting this is really hard because they need to not only plan for what they're growing and cultivating this year, but next year and the year after that. So to make this, you know, to make this whole situation so unstable is rough on some people. I mean, we have heard from farmers who say that they absolutely understood when they were voting for Donald Trump that this is what they were going to get. And they knew that this is something that he promised and that they want to ride out this wave. And they think in the end that things will be better off if the U.S. can win this battle with China over trade.
We're talking about trade right now, the effect of the tariffs on Ohio farmers, the retaliatory tariffs that are pinching soybean farmers and pork producers, among others, here in Ohio. Our State House Reporter Roundtable is here. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher today on All Sides. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also, check out the All Sides Facebook page. Jim, this is exactly what President Trump promised, as Andy mentioned. This is he's been saying unfair trade since the 80s when he was on Oprah Winfrey's show back in the 80s or early 90s, saying that we were getting, you know, unfairly treated, to use a polite term, by nations around the world. So to say that people should be surprised by this, they really shouldn't be surprised. I think there was some hope that as president he would not do as he promised, as many politicians do. Yeah. On this one, he is sticking with his promise.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is the key. You know, there is this not a surprise that he is trying this. And frankly, if you are going to go after trade issues, I mean, China is the best target for the United States. From you know, I'm not going to pretend to be some kind of trade expert, but from everything I know, I mean, from their currency manipulation over the years and all the other, you know, the labor that they, the child labor issues and other things that, you know, where they manipulate the markets in ways that we cannot. I mean, it does produce cheaper goods, but at the same time, it hurts and kills off a lot of American jobs. So yeah, if you're gonna target someone, China would be your the one. Now, I mean, again, there is a lot of debate to be had whether the tariffs and the way we're going about it is the proper way to do it. You know, as we've said before, you know, a number of times, the farmers are not what is it? They want trade, not aid.
Yes.
I think that's the line we're hearing a lot of. And like Andy said, I mean, farmers are not, you know, because of the nature of the way that their businesses operate, they're not nimble. They can't quickly, you know, change production and, you know, and suddenly start doing new things. They need some stability. Now, will this all work out in the end? I don't know. I also don't think it, I'm not sure how much it helped that we, you know, kind of roped in Canada, Mexico, and the European Union in all this as well in terms of this trade fight. But I mean, you know, we, I guess we have to wait and see whether it all turns out to be better. But like again, it goes beyond farming. Like Whirlpool,
yeah.
I mean, Whirlpool stock plunged because they're getting hammered on the imported steel and other costs to make washing machines and such.
Because the tariffs increase the price, the world market on aluminum and steel. I mean, you have auto manufacturers worried about tariffs on European cars and European auto parts. Jeremy, it's just – it could take – if all of this – if these tariffs stick, it really could take decades to see if this worked or not. Do people have the patience to farm – President Trump asked farmers to be patient. Do people have the patience to see if these trade policies will work?
well, it's not even clear if this is the end. Yep. You know, this is might not even be the beginning of the end. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, like, you know, be patient, but we're not talking like, oh, wait till next year. I mean, then it becomes almost like an entitlement program where you have billions and billions going to these farmers every year because to offset, and then it just becomes just in place because, you know, most government programs when they start, it's awfully hard to stop them.
Yeah,
when you hear $12 billion, it might sound like a lot, but not if you consider that this trade war, if we're going to call it a trade war, if you consider this could go on for a year, 2 years, this could go on for a long time. And farmers are going to need a lot more than $12 billion if they're going to try to be able to sustain the impact of all of this.
Not to mention if it's other things, too.
Other industries, right.
Yeah, yeah. Linda Murkowski in Alaska. What about the shellfish and the fishermen up in Alaska who are seeing retaliatory tariffs? Where's their aid? And then where's the Whirlpool washing machine aid?
Exactly. Where does it end? Because there's a whole lot of industries that are going to be affected by this. And I don't know how you pick and choose which ones get the aid and which ones don't, and it will get expensive fast.
And I will say just real quick, we should consider the other end because I'm sure people in China are also seeing, you know, the counterbalance on their end. I mean, they are a huge importer of soy from the U.S. So if China is cutting off the access to soy from China, then that's hurting businesses in China as well. So it's just important to consider that aspect.
Yeah. And you need to see if this even passes WTO muster. You may have to see, like, we have all these agreements in place and, you know, trade agreements and the system after World War II designed that they're not very happy with these kind of things. And I can see, you know, that being an issue as well.
Actually, I saw a number this morning as I was watching some morning news that apparently like 0.6% of the GDP growth from last quarter, or the 4.1% growth, apparently 0.6% of it was just because China pre-ordered a whole bunch of soybeans in order to get ahead of the tariffs.
Wow.
I mean, that's think about it in terms of the total economy. That is a lot of soybeans.
It's a lot of tofu.
Yeah, I mean, people front-loaded all their imports, and then we'll see what happens, see if there's, you know, next quarter, if it drops back. Let's go to a call. Bill in Clintonville wants to talk about trade and President Trump. Go ahead, Bill, you're on the air.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't there some prominent politicians and activists on the left who disagree with Trump on 98% of what he's done, but who agree with Trump in opposing NAFTA and in opposing some of these international trade agreements, and who agree with Trump that the U.S. has gotten some bad trade deals over the years? Thinking of Sherrod Brown, doesn't he in some cases agree with Trump on some of this trade stuff?
No, absolutely. Thanks for the call, Bill. Yeah, he said he agrees with these tariffs.
Yeah, Bill. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, Jeremy was talking about politics in the coming future. You know, these are the people who have who President Trump appealed to in the steel counties and the rural counties. Those are the people that Sherrod Brown also has an appeal towards. And it's going to be interesting how, you know, both of those people have the same talking points when it comes to trade. But now we've seen the effect of this trade. So it's going to be interesting to see if those same voters who were happy with those talking points in the past might sing a different tune this coming election.
Jeremy, Rob Portman, free trader, he was the trade representative under President Bush. He disagrees with the president on this, but he has not been terribly vocal about his disagreement with the president.
Well, Rob Portman is rarely vocally disagreeing on a whole lot of things.
He's really very vocal. Yes.
Yeah.
Very understated guy.
I mean, as Jim said earlier, I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that you would expect from like a Sherrod Brown or like a Bernie Sanders type. But then there's a promise. It's easy to make the promise of, oh, okay, we're going to help steel people, or we're going to help American business and help American economies. But then when you actually go through and actually do it, it's like, oh, okay, there's unintended consequences. It starts a whole different thing. And so it's one thing to make a campaign promise, and like this is any president, one thing to make a campaign promise and another follow through with it.
And I think also one of the issues too is, it's one thing to say that, these trade deals are bad, but I think too much of what we're hearing is we have a trade deficit, so these trade deals are bad. I think it is way more complicated than that, and there's way more to it than just the number on the trade deficit. Yeah. That's what President Trump likes to focus on, but there's more to that number than just these trade deals. And I think I sense there's some lack of comfort because there just doesn't seem to be a lot of good rational explaining as to, well, what exactly is wrong with these trade deals? What exactly about NAFTA is hurting us? What about the deal we had with over in the East? What about that deal is hurting us?
We got to get to a break. It's all about the winning and losing. We're losing on the trade deficit. It sounds good in a soundbite, but there's a lot of reasons as to why that scoreboard looks the way it does. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the 12th Congressional District. We have a week and one day until voters complete voting in the race to fill the seat left vacant by former Congressman Pat Tiberi. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We try to get a head start on what people are going to be talking about during the course of the week. Joining us, Jeremy Pelzer, a political reporter for Cleveland.com, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Andy Chow, State House reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We are 1 week and one day away from a special election that is starting to gain more and more national attention. This is the special election in the 12th Congressional District to fill the seat left vacant by Pat Tiberi when he left last winter. The 12th Congressional District, basically, if you can picture it, covers maybe the far northern slice of Franklin County, up to Delaware County, up into even Mansfield and over to Newark and then down into Zanesville. It's kind of like a little Jerry Curl, we call it, a little gerrymandered district that curls around some of the rural areas in eastern central Ohio. For all intents and purposes, this looks like a tight race. We knew it would be tight. Now the two political prognosticators, the Cook Report and Kyle Condit from the University of Virginia, say this is a toss-up. Jeremy, you've been covering this race. What can we expect in these last 8 days?
For the past couple of months, it's been comparatively quiet, but now suddenly it's really picking up. You have Mike Pence in campaigning today. Their news broke today that there's just another $1 million of spending from the congressional Republicans. I think that makes it now something like $5-6 million spent on this race. And this is like a really condensed campaign because it's not November, it's August.
Yep.
And this is a district that in a normal year, Republicans would have no business losing, that Democrats would have no chance winning, but it's not a normal year.
Donald Trump carried this district by 11 points in 2016. Jeremy, when you see $1 million ad buy in the last week, they've already spent – this will bring their total – this is Paul Ryan's super PAC. They've spent about $2.5 million total on this district. What does that tell you? Democrats have spent a lot of outside money coming from national Democrats organizations as well, just not as much as the GOP side.
I mean, it obviously says that – I mean, this is money that could be spent elsewhere, and they're spending it here, which means that they think it's needed. Not only do they think that Troy Balderson has a chance, who's a Republican in the race, but that also means that they think he's in trouble.
Andy, how do you see this race?
Well, I think the interesting thing, I mean, of course, this is the special election, and then we have, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but then we have the the election in November for the full
This is the hors d'oeuvre, then the main course is in November.
And so some people say, well, this is just to, you know, this is just the special election. The real thing is in November. But I think the implication here is that, you know, the nation can be watching this special election. And if somebody like Danny O'Connor, a Democrat, wins in a heavily, heavily favored Republican district, that could send, you know, alarm bells throughout the country that maybe this blue wave thing that people keep talking about might be real. And that could lead to more donations, bigger fundraising, more boots on the ground to start knocking on doors and campaigning all around the country. Because, you know, again, if Danny Connor were to pull this thing out, then, you know, it could be huge.
Mm-hmm. Mike Pence is in town, as Jeremy mentioned. Mike Pence is in Newark today, to be exact, campaigning mm-hmm. for Troy Baldessin. Troy Baldessin does very well. He's from Zanesville, so he'll do very well in the rural areas. Danny O'Connor is counting on strong vote from Franklin County and maybe southern Delaware County or New Albany area of Licking County. Donald Trump's not coming. It's probably wise on the GOP side. Democrats are already fired up. I think if Donald Trump would have come, Jim, that would fire them up even more.
Right. I mean, Donald Trump just got done saying that he's going to campaign six days a week for congressional members who are in trouble. But he has not yet made an appearance here. And frankly, I have no idea of this, but I'm not sure that Troy Baldessin's campaign is too sad about that. I think Mike Pence is a more palatable choice for them to come out here and help them out. But yeah, they've had some heavy hitters come out here. I mean, they've had Pence, the House Speaker Paul Ryan has come out here himself. The Majority Leader has come out. So there's, you know, he's getting a lot of big guns to come out and help him out a lot. And is getting a lot of money to help in what should be a much easier race. But as we know, this is a different kind of year. O'Connor's been getting a lot of help, too, but it's the kind of the help you don't hear about as much because it's not big names and it's not big money. For example, they have mobilized folks all across the country to write notes to voters in the 12th district on postcards. And I'm not talking about a note that says, hey, vote for Danny O'Connor.
Yeah.
Please. I mean, these are elaborate notes on these cards that are coming out and
handwritten.
Wow. Elaborate notes that are being sent all over the district to Democrats to get them active and fired up to come out in an election where they normally don't, or, you know, normally still worrying about the end of the summer and their vacations. So he's getting help, too. It's just not the kind that you see up on TV.
Yeah. Eric Holder was in town for O'Connor. Correct. Last week, mm-hmm. Former Attorney General. He's not asking Elizabeth Warren to come to town. He's not asking Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton to come to town to campaign.
Or Nancy Pelosi.
Well, that brings up Nancy Pelosi. Danny O'Connor was in Washington, D.C. last week and for some reason thought it'd be a good idea to go on Hardball with Chris Matthews. And he went after him for his denunciation or showing he's saying he would not support Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, and kind of got him to say that, you know, if there was no other Democrat to run for Speaker, he would vote for Nancy Pelosi. But how much does that matter in this race?
It doesn't, unless you live in the political bubble. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been talking to voters. I haven't met a single one who's like, man, I don't know who to vote for. Nancy Pelosi or Jim Jordan for Speaker, that's what I care about. I haven't heard that. I mean, this is such a small election campaign period that you can't really do issues on like nuanced issues. You can't work it out. It's just, hey, Danny O'Connor likes liberal Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. and you have to do these black or white attack ads to get voters to come out. And it's not going to be even that many voters coming out either.
I think the problem for the Republicans is that Danny O'Connor has not, you know, gone far left. He's been trying to stay in the middle. He's been trying to identify himself with conservatives like John Kasich, people who are appearing more moderate. And so if the Republicans can try to stick him to, like Jeremy said, to liberal Nancy Pelosi, who has this name recognition and people have this visceral, you know, reaction to hearing her name, maybe they think that that'll get more conservatives to, you know, rally up and go out and vote against him.
Yeah, O'Connor has been trying very hard to be the moderate Democrat, similar to what Connor Lamb did mm-hmm. in Western Pennsylvania mm-hmm. when he won that race earlier in the spring. And the Republican goal is to say, no, he's not a moderate. He's a liberal. He's with Nancy Pelosi. He's with Hillary Clinton. He's with Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren.
What this is going to come down to is, so you have a bunch of rural counties. Well, if you want to call Delaware a rural county, it's comparatively to
Northern
Franklin.
Northern Delaware County.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you're, Danny O'Connor's going to win Franklin County. He's going to try to run up the score there. And then it's a matter of how much, how narrow does he lose to Troy Balderson in these other areas? So if it's it's not a matter if you win or lose these counties, it's a matter of percentages. So if you can run up the score in Franklin and just kind of hang in there in Licking, Delaware, Muskingum, all these different other counties, that's his path to victory. And so when he's appealing to these conservative voters, he's trying to just stay above water in these other counties.
You know, I think something that's interesting is that I was with a group of people. They are Franklin County voters, and they were talking about this race. And I feel like this is something you don't usually hear about in Franklin County. You know, it's a special election, so it's already a little, you know, less turnout anyway. But it's the big talk of Franklin County right now. So just that alone, I think, like you said, Danny O'Connor might have a chance to run up the scoreboard in Franklin County.
Well, of the major party voters in the early voting right now, 87% in Franklin County are Democrats.
Yeah.
87. I mean, in 2016, only 52% of early votes were Republicans. Now it's 87% Democrats. In Delaware County, it's 54% Democrats. In a county that is definitely that 70% Republican cast early votes in 2016, and Democrats in Licking County, 49% of them are the early voters, and they were only, I think, 32% in 2016. Now, I'm usually not one to put much stock in early voting because, frankly, Republicans are much more reliable voters on election day. Mm-hmm. But this is a special election in a different kind of year, and so I think those kind of numbers have got to worry some Republicans.
But
early voting shows can indicate organization, mm-hmm, and good grassroots organization and getting your vote out. And it appears – it also shows motivation. But it appears that the Democrats are more motivated as far as early voting goes. They tend to vote more early anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But as Jim mentioned, those percentages are noteworthy.
But I will say we saw similar early voting numbers in the gubernatorial primary earlier this year. And then when it came to Election Day and counting up all the votes after Election Day, the script actually flipped and there was a bigger Republican turnout. So again, like we're saying, Democrats like to vote early, but there's a huge turnout of Republicans on the actual Election Day.
Let's put it this way. If you are listening to this right now and you are registered to vote in the 12th district, this is an election you should be voting because your vote will matter more than in November. And here's why. Because Paul Beck from Ohio State was on this show last week, and he said he expects maybe like a 10% turnout. That's 55,000 votes. Mm. And if you have 55,000 votes, that means 28,000 votes, 28,000 votes will win this thing.
Yeah.
So if you have a low turnout election like this, it might even help the Republican. Mm. I mean, usually high turnout helps the Democrat. In this instance, if you have high turnout outside of Franklin County, that would actually help Balderson.
We're talking about the 12th Congressional District race right here on our Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. That was Jeremy Pelzer from the Cleveland.com. Also with us, Jim Siegel from the Dispatch and Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio. We mentioned this is the first game of a doubleheader. And unless somebody blows the other candidate out, this really just we'll find out who wins next week. That person will take office. That either Troy Balderson or Danny O'Connor, and they'll be back at each other almost immediately campaigning for November.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What's the thinking on, you know, if Danny O'Connor wins in August, he's a shoo-in in November. If Troy Balderson wins big here, then Danny O'Connor doesn't have a chance in November. Is there any thinking for the second game of the doubleheader?
I think if Troy Balderson wins, that pulls out a solid win, you know, 8, 10, 12 points. I think that might spell the end, mm-hmm, of the fight for November. If Danny, if he wins by 1 or 2 points, I don't know. I think that's going to have to be an evaluation by the Democratic Party and the DCCC and whether they still think they can pull this out in and up their margins and up their totals in a general election. Now, if Danny O'Connor wins, I think I think that is a big deal for him, because then all of a sudden he gets a lot of fundraising boost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden now he doesn't have to be calling everybody as candidate Danny O'Connor. He can say, look, I pulled this off and we can keep this seat. So, and you know, that would be a big help for him. If he can get into office and start using the power of that office to raise money.
I would say a 2-point win by Danny O'Connor is better than a 2-point win by Troy Balderson, I would think, because that'll just continue the campaign.
Yeah, and I think it'll also tell you what talking points are working. And so if Danny O'Connor were to win, he would realize, oh, then, you know, the things I'm talking about, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, the things that I'm talking about with, you know, wanting new leadership in charge on the Democratic side, those things are working. He can lean on those more. And again, you're seeing a huge pump of money. I think the one thing I wonder how this will, you know, affect everything is voter fatigue. So, you know, voters are getting slammed with ads now, and it's in August, and they have this big turnout, and there's this big momentum shift. But then are they really ready to get back up and do it all over again in November? Are they really going to, are they going to be tired of it all by then?
Of course, in November, Jeremy, this will be one of many races on the ballot. So you're going to have the Rich Cordray folks coming out who may not come out for this one, or maybe on vacation this one. And you're going to have the
Sherrod
Mike
Brown.
DeWine folks come out, and the turnout metric totally changes for November.
And plus, there's another minor factor if it's a close race, which is you're going to have a Libertarian on the November ballot whose name is also O'Connor.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and so that might throw something in the mix, because Libertarians tend to take more from the Republicans than Democrats, but he has the same last name as the Democratic nominee.
The O'Connor campaign knows what they're doing. On his yard signs, the word Danny is bigger than O'Connor. Again, it's fewer letters, but they make sure that the Danny is prominent in their sides, on their signs. Our phone number is 614-292-8513. I had one more question on this race, and I know what it was. Pat Tiberi. Mm. He left this seat to take a job with the Columbus Business Roundtable.
Ohio
Business Roundtable, here, based here in Columbus. A pretty lucrative position. Said he couldn't pass it up. But he's really – he was involved in the primary. He endorsed Troy Balderson in the primary, but I have not seen him much in this race. I have not seen an ad with Pat Tiberi. I have not seen him campaigning with Troy Balderson. Maybe I'm wrong. Have we seen him campaigning for
not
this?
Not publicly, no.
No, he hasn't been involved, and I don't know. I have not. I don't know why. I don't know if that's a personal choice or if it's because the business, you know, the position he's in now. Yeah. They, you know, the CEOs have told him stay out of this one. Or I don't know.
He might be just trying to keep it apolitical in his new position.
Yeah,
I will say the person who had the seat before Pat Tiberi, John Kasich, just came out last week to endorse Troy Balderson. So, and I think
it's
kind
of late, isn't it? A little
later. And, you know, and when we talked to the governor last week, he said expect something soon. But you could tell that he was sort of weighing his options as well.
Jeremy, does a John Kasich endorsement help Troy Balderson in Muskingum County and the more rural parts of this district where he's not as popular as, say, Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, Balderson covers his flank with more conservative voters because he has.
Yeah.
So he has the best of both worlds. You have a Trump endorsement and then you have a Kasich endorsement. So, but at the same time, you know, this is a
Danny O'Connor is tying himself to Daniel, John Kasich.
So on the one hand, it's interesting because both candidates have been seeking John Kasich's supporters. In fact, the Democrat has been seeking him more than Balderson has. But this is a district that isn't fundamentalist conservative as others. This is a more affluent, more educated, more John Kasich type district.
Yeah. All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about issue one. It's on the ballot coming up in the fall. Also, other issues that will be in the news this week as the Reporters Roundtable continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. We're joined by Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio. Jim, as we mentioned, you're excited to be back because you just came back from vacation in Hawaii.
Yes.
And just curious, you were talking off the air about the politics out there. Yeah, I saw you on Twitter. You visited the Hawaii State House, which kind of looked like just an office building. But
yeah, although it has some weird, like, volcano-shaped arches or mounds on each side, which is kind of unique.
That's where the hot air comes out from.
Right. Are they active volcanoes? That's what I want to know.
That was on the other side of the island. Yeah.
What's politics like in Hawaii? Is it more laid back than here?
It actually is. I was mentioning before, they have an election coming up next Tuesday as well. I was just struck by all the radio ads and how polite they were. I mean, it's all just, hey, can you, I really appreciate your vote. Here's the kind of things I support. Hey, my friend, blah, 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 is running for state house and would really do a great job. And yeah, they weren't slick ads. They weren't well produced. They were just sort of people talking. And it was just kind of, almost a little refreshing to kind of just hear people talk about why, nice reasons why you should vote for them.
I know you're probably not an expert on Hawaii, but you were there. Is it part of the whole laid back beach culture?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. I mean, I think that's just the culture there. It's just there. I'm sure it does get nasty at times and probably will as it gets somewhat towards November. But at least the ads I was hearing on the radio were just very, it was all a lot of polite, nice ads.
That makes me wonder what the Hawaii State House press corps is like. I wonder if they're laid back too.
Well, they do have, and they have the lowest unemployment rate in the nation.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
It's like 2% or something.
That's incredible. So. Yeah. All right. Well, back to reality.
Back to Columbus.
Yeah, welcome back, Jim.
And now,
we get the black and white grainy pictures of Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump.
I saw a number of those when I got back.
Yeah. At the State House, it looks like the payday lending issue is nearing an end. After a long battle, the Ohio House has now passed a bill to regulate payday lending. This is after the Senate passed its version of the bill. The new legislation reins in those interest rates, capping them at 28% APR. When you figure in all the fees and everything else, the actual highest percentage rate, according to the studies, puts it at 60%, which is far less than the nearly 500% interest rate that Pew found that payday lenders, short-term lenders, were charging here in Ohio. Andy, Governor Kasich says he likes the bill and likely will sign it.
Yeah, he says that this is something that he's been wanting for a long time, although we didn't really hear him advocate for it when it was moving through the House and Senate that much. But so the bill has been sent to his desk, so I think we can expect him to sign it in the next week or so. This is something that I think could get national attention because this is a pretty comprehensive reform, similar to what Colorado's done, a little less restrictive maybe than what Colorado's done. And what'll be interesting is, I mean, we've heard the talking points over and over again from the payday lending industry that they say this will close down storefronts and that this will hurt their business. But again, a lot of those same payday lenders have storefronts in Colorado and they haven't gone out of business yet there. So it'll be interesting to see what the actual, implications are to this measure.
Jim, we've been down this road before. We've cracked down on payday lenders. Legislature passed things. They went to the vote after the legislature passed it, but they found a way around it. Is confidence high that 28% APR is firm and even 60% total, including all the fees, that's as high as the interest rates are going to go on these?
I think confidence is higher this time that they've got it reined in. I mean, you learn from your past mistakes. I mean, the mistake from the last one is lenders were just able to move to different parts of the law. They became credit service organizations. Money started getting loaned out under the Mortgage Loan Act. I mean, statutes that were never written with payday lenders in mind, but they were able to do it. And this time they believe that they've reined them in under a part of the law that will cap their rates and some more some of the bigger points of this is there's going to be no more 2-week loans or 4-week loans for $500 or whatever, where the big problem was people just, you know, if I don't have $500 today and I need to borrow it, I'm certainly not going to have it in 2 weeks from now to repay it back plus another $50 and $60 in fees.
Yep.
So I have to take out a loan again and again and again. And so that's the cycle that's being that'll be broken here, because you can't only require them to repay a certain amount per month based on their income. And so a lot of these loans will be stretched out for, you know, two, three, 6 months. And so giving people a reasonable time to repay them. And yeah, the industry has said that this will shut down stores, and I don't disagree, but I don't think – I doubt it will shut all of them down. I mean, there's about 650 payday lending stores in Ohio. If half of them close – I mean, I can do that math. That's still 325 payday lenders in Ohio. And so, you know, it's hard to – if that is what in fact happens, it's kind of hard to argue that there won't be available access to this.
Yeah, Jim mentioned what might be the most important aspect of this whole thing is that the way the regulatory format has been made up of now – people can pull out a loan, they can't pay it off, so they go to a different lender and they pull out a loan to pay off the first loan, and then they get into this cycle of debt where they're just drowning. And so the way that this legislation is created is supposed to stop that from happening. Somebody can pull out money. They are supposed to have a pretty reasonable schedule to be able to pay it off without too much interest rate being tacked onto it. So again, it'll be interesting to see if it really does stop people from really getting into a horrible situation when it comes to debt.
Jeremy, would this bill have passed if it were not for what we believe is an FBI investigation into former House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger's travel and support from lobbyists, namely from the payday loan industry?
Well, first I might say to add on to the last point, I mean, even under the bill, if you take a $1,000 loan, after a year these companies can still charge like $530 of interest. So it's you can't charge 500% interest, but it's
still steep.
It's
steep
not
interest rates.
Yeah, it's not bank interest.
And the interest the payday lenders would argue the reason why they charge these interest rates is because this is a high risk customer. These are folks who often cannot pay and do not pay the loans back, so they have to charge the interest rates to offer this service to offset folks who don't pay it back. But again, back to the politics with Cliff Rosenberger, that it sort of is we haven't heard much lately about this investigation, but that's the cloud that was hanging over this legislation.
Right. Well, I mean, it was. This whole thing is about more than just payday lending, of course. You know, it's become much more than that because, obviously, as you said, the now former Speaker of the House was accused or being investigated for going on these trips, among others, with payday lending lobbyists. And so now there's sort of that cloud that has been hanging over it. Would it have passed in this form without it? I mean, it's hard to say, but certainly there, and in the wake of it, there was a lot more movement, and it got up pretty quickly after all that happened.
I do think that had a big effect on the speed at which it suddenly moved out of the House. However, there were other factors as well. There was a payday lending ballot issue that was getting signatures to go on in 2019. And if anyone saw what happened 10 years ago, where the payday lenders outspent the opponents by 10-1 and still lost 2-1, I mean, there was little doubt that if that actually made it to the ballot, it was going to pass. There was Rich Cordray is running for governor, and Rich Cordray's former job was the head of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the agency whose number one thing was produce new rules for payday lenders so that they, you know, as the Bureau would say, and as Cordray repeatedly said, stop ripping off the low-income borrowers. He would have made this a huge issue in the campaign had they not done this. So, yes, Jeremy's right. This is definitely about more than just payday lending. If it wasn't, This problem would have been fixed, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, but there were definitely other factors involved.
Does this mean it's not a campaign issue going forward?
Yeah, I think it definitely takes a wind out of the sails of Rich Cordray. Like Jim said, I mean, he could have been at the front of this issue. He could have been talking about how he was trying to protect consumers for years on this issue, and now that the legislature
he still might mention that,
and he can, but now that the legislature,
the Republican legislature,
correct, he can't paint Republicans, the Republican legislature, he can't paint Mike DeWine as somebody who's against these things. So it just kind of, like I said, takes a little bit of the muscle out of it. You know, you asked, would this have passed if not for the reported FBI probe? I think, like Jeremy and Jim said, the speed at which it passed is definitely a factor. And I think just it, I think a lot of people are surprised by how strong this bill actually is and how comprehensive it is. The differences between how it was drafted and where it ended up is not very big. And it was really on the brink of sustaining a lot of amendments to what supporters said would weaken the bill. And it didn't really go through that process.
Well, and that was fascinating in both chambers. I mean, in the House, the first person who started off as kind of the lead person to kind of craft a new bill was Bill Sites.
Yeah.
And Bill Sites is very much a supporter of the payday lending industry. Well, he got kicked off and Kirk Schering came in, and then it ended up the way it did. And then when it went to the Senate, it was Matt Huffman who was put on the bill. Matt Huffman, a very big supporter of the payday lending industry. He tried to rewrite it in a pro-payday way. He got kicked off. And when others were brought in, and then it was written the way it is now. So there were definitely some interesting twists and turns on this bill, and it very easily could have gone differently, except I think for some of these other factors that I think there were some leaders over there who just took a look at this and eventually said, you know what, I'm not sure we can come to an agreement on this with the industry. We just need to pass something strong.
Yeah.
And just to add just one other weird twist to all this is that you saw a lot of Republican legislators kind of bashing the lobbyists, which they're usually pretty cozy with them at the State House and during committee meetings. But you saw several legislators during committee meetings, you know, scrutinizing and criticizing these payday lenders, which is kind of a rare sight.
It's kind of like ECOT all over again. Mm-hmm. When an industry becomes so toxic, you know, it's not worth the political capital to with the fundraising, let that go by the boards. And you don't want to be labeled as being part of the whole culture of corruption, as the Democrats will say at this campaign. Let's get to one issue that will be on the ballot this fall. It's issue one. It's, for lack of a better term, the drug penalty amendment. It would change the Ohio Constitution, basically classifying some very low-level drug possession charges from felonies to misdemeanors, which would mean that, for the most part, folks who are charged with possessing drugs without an intent to distribute, to sell them, or drug paraphernalia likely would not see jail time, would not see prison time, unless they were a repeat offender. This is on the ballot. Will this make a difference? Where is this coming from?
Well, this is coming from several groups who have been urging for criminal sentencing reform. Basically, when you hear people talk about the issue of nonviolent drug offenses and reforming the criminal justice system so we don't just put everybody in jail, put everybody in prison, this would, like you said, make those offenses that would maybe sometimes be felonies, make them misdemeanors instead, so maybe somebody goes on probation or just pays a fine. And it's really targeting those nonviolent drug offenders. And you're hearing a lot of support for it. It seemed to have a pretty easy time getting the signatures they needed. But you are starting to see, as with every issue, when an issue officially becomes part of the ballot, you're starting to see an opposition form. Justice Paul Pfeiffer, who used the former justice on the Supreme Court, has come out against it. He's against, you know, putting any sort of thing like this in the Constitution.
Yeah. And it's also retroactive. So if there are folks now in prison for these low level crimes under this thing, they could get out. And you could see that generating some controversy.
I mean, the context for this is that Ohio for years has been working to try to Ohio's prison population has been growing, and the Kasich administration and others have been working to try to find alternatives to prison. And this is just the latest effort in like a years long effort to reduce that population.
And one part of it is interesting, I think, is that it requires the state to spend the savings off of those, you know, by the reduced prison population, spend that saved money on drug treatment and crime victims and rehab. I will just say, for those who think that is going to make a big difference, ask the schools about the Ohio lottery.
Yes, the money didn't quite make it to its intended source. Will this, I mean, the Richard Cordray has come out in favor of it. I'm not sure if Mike
DeWine does not
support
he
it.
He opposes
it. Former prosecutor in Greene County. I don't know where prosecutors as a whole feel on this.
I reached out to the Prosecutors Association, haven't heard from them yet. I know the Ohio Judicial Conference is still getting together to come up with an official statement, but Paul Pfeiffer heads up that group, and he's against it.
I think putting it in the Constitution is going to make turn a lot of people against it in those circles.
All right. That was Jim Siegel, Jeremy Pelzer, Andy Chow. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Reporters Roundtable.
Yeah.
This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today on 89.7 NPR News.